Our guest speaker this morning is Michael Esselin, who will be speaking about where the theology meets the road. He will explore what happens during a crisis of illness or death with thoughts and beliefs. There are common themes that surface from atheists or fundamentalists alike. Patients' various theologies that were thought to be firmly held tend to intersect during these crises. Michael Esselin is an oncology chaplain at the Sims Mann UCLA Center for Integrative Oncology. He is co-founder of the GLIDE Anti-Homophilia Speakers Bureau. He now has a TED Talk online via YouTube called Magic, and he has been this congregation's most frequent guest speaker. Let us welcome Michael Esselin.
Well, good morning again. When I first had the idea for this particular talk, I ran it by my husband, Scott, and he looked a little befuddled at first, like the RCA Victor dog or something, with his head cocked sideways. And so I explained it to him again, and all he said was, "Well, it sounds a little heady to me, Michael, but I'm sure you'll bring it down into some human terms, and it'll be just great." So with that vote of confidence, I find myself here, but I am keeping my eye peeled for the head cocked sideways. But the way I see it, this is about as basic as it gets. What do we believe? What do we hold to be true? What's the primary lens through which we view the bigger questions about life and death? What's it all about, Alfie? As Unitarian Universalists, we tend to keep those questions at the forefront, encouraging our own individual and collective exploration for answers. Other faith traditions offer up answers, and they demand, in varying degrees, adherence to that point of view. What I have found in my work as an oncology chaplain, though, is that we may think we know what we believe, but when it gets right down to it, when faced with a crisis like critical illness or death, where the theology meets the road, often all bets are off. I have been with dozens of devout Christians, Catholics, who, when faced with the end, will admit, "I don't know what comes next. I'd like to believe in heaven, sure, but I really don't know." And likewise, I've been with plenty of secular folks who, when faced with the finish line, will admit they can't quite accept that this is the whole story. They will sometimes share with me mystical experiences they've had. They claim they've never shared with anyone. Perhaps it just didn't toe the secular party line, or maybe they just didn't have a context in which to hold such an experience. Sometimes faith systems remain whole, complete, intact. Sometimes they collapse altogether. And sometimes they just crack open the teeniest bit, allowing room for an often disquieting visitor: doubt. That's the intersection I wanted to explore this morning. Because you see, just as patients have to hold those big questions of what do I really believe now, so it is that I have to hold those questions as I walk beside them. And my hope and invitation to you is that perhaps some of these reflections will resonate and reverberate, even though crisis may be at bay, for now. There are a handful of theological themes that I see come up again and again from folks all over the belief map, from religious fundamentalists to secular humanists and everyone in between. And as I explore these, I do see the irony that I'm even attempting to refine and distill hundreds of personal stories to come up with something vaguely universal here, when, if anything, I deplore the idea of singular universal truth. But there you go. Still, I'd like to believe there may be something universally human here that has room in it for contradiction and paradox and doubt. John Patrick Shanley, who wrote that beautiful piece I read earlier, is a playwright. He wrote a Pulitzer Prize-winning play called Doubt, and they made a film of the same name. He says that the opposite of faith isn't doubt, it's certainty. And certainty is certainly one of those themes that I see come up again and again. I know this to be true. I know that God loves me and hears my prayer. I know there's a place for me in heaven. I know that God doesn't give us any more than we can handle. I know that God helps those who help themselves. That's often attributed to the Bible, but that's actually Benjamin Franklin speaking. Or in a different vein, I know that my thought creates my reality. I know everything happens for a reason. I know that what goes around comes around. Or in a different vein, I know there's no truth beyond science. I know that there's no law beyond nature, and that there's no reality beyond this one. The fact is, using illustrations from patients' lives, I could make a very good case for the truth or falsehood of any one of those statements of faith. Prove them or disprove them, if you will. But to what end? It's not a court case. Judith Meyer, who retired from our pulpit in Santa Monica years ago, used to begin every Sunday morning by reminding us that we're here to practice what it means to be human. And to me, there's something fundamentally human in the way that we crave and pursue and take comfort in our certainty, only to sometimes miss the magic of its collapse. When I first walked into Stan's room, he was alone in the bed with an oxygen mask on. I introduced myself as the chaplain, and he waved me away right away, rather dismissively. But not without first lifting up his mask and spitting out as quickly and precisely as possible in a near singular monotone breath, "I know the Lord Jesus Christ is my personal Savior, and by his stripes I shall be healed. Thank you so much for coming." And he put the mask back on. Stan's a perfect example of what I've come to call shrink wrap theology. I've seen dozens like him, and not just religious folks, secular folks too. It's as if he's wrapped so tightly in his theology and his beliefs that he remains as impenetrable as a new CD. Some might say that his faith is so solid and so strong that he's all set, that he'll be just fine. And that may be, mechanically speaking anyway, and if everything goes well. But one could also say that the full depth and breadth of his experience, his journey through cancer, is lost on him. He remains impervious to it. There is no room whatsoever for awakening or discovery or revelation or even transformation. I could also hear a certain distress in the way that he clung to his certainty, much in the same way there's distress in his body clinging to the oxygen coming from that mask, as if that theology is another kind of mask. Javier was a young man, early 30s, leukemia patient, the kind of a patient who, once I introduced myself as a chaplain, he kind of wanted to show off for me a little bit, spiritually speaking. He wanted to show me how spiritually solid he was. So he told me about his church community. He shows me his Bible and his books and his CDs. His church community, while he had grown up in a large Latino Catholic family, as an adult he found a greater connection to a more evangelical Christian community. So he used a lot of language like, "As the head of the house, I want to walk with the Lord, and I want to surround myself with the right kinds of people. My brother is just not right with the Lord, no matter what I say to him, and so I just can't be around him anymore." His faith was in his certainty. Still, I could hear a certain unease beneath his platitudes, and I asked him to tell me more about what he meant by the right kinds of people. And I asked him to consider if he thought Jesus would make such distinctions. Well, that opened the conversation wide. And then we could really talk about his judgments of others, but most importantly, his judgments toward himself. And finally, 45 minutes later, the truth came seeping out in his tears, beneath his mask of certainty, when he said, "To tell you the truth, Michael, I don't think I'm going to make it, and I don't deserve it." Wow. It was like this enormous exhale after holding his breath for as long as humanly possible. And what was left was room to breathe in another kind of air that I would just as soon call grace, to be who he is, a scared human being with far more questions than answers. Deserving is such a loaded word, and yet it's inextricably linked to all these other themes that I see come up again and again. Closely linked to deserving is the idea that I'm special. I'm special, and therefore I'm entitled to good things, to health, success, wealth, love, whatever it is, salvation. Closely linked to deserving, but in slight contrast to being special or entitled, is the idea that good things have to be earned, that I must somehow prove myself worthy in order to have love, health, success, salvation, whatever it is. Now, while that idea may seem to be shot through the lens of some Protestant work ethic, that idea is also prevalent in Eastern thought. It's certainly present in New Age thought. And it's certainly present in American humanist tradition in the way that we revere self-made men and women. They earned it, by golly. Closely linked to earning is the idea that I have some power or control here over outcomes and circumstances. That if I can do, be, say, pray, or eat the right thing, somehow I'm going to be okay, I'm going to be healed, I'm going to be safe. All of these ideas are huddled under the same umbrella of belief that would even say there is such a thing as a force for goodness and justice and love in the world. I'm not here to say any of these are the correct beliefs and should be encouraged, or that they're misguided and should be avoided, or that I don't hold them myself, given the day you ask me. I only mean to share that I see them revealed again and again in times of crisis from folks all over the belief map. Even when, as in Javier's case, initially there are declarations to something quite different, ultimately, I don't deserve this, he said. I also mean to caution that I think some of these ideas can trip us up, or more precisely by how tightly we hold on to them. Phyllis was the embodiment of I am special. It was the end of the day on a Friday. I was pretty darn pooped and ready to go, but I saw there was one newly admitted patient I had not met, so I thought I'll just pop in and introduce myself before the weekend. I just stick my head in the door and say, "Hi, I'm Michael, I'm the chaplain," and she bellows out, "Oh, the Lord has truly answered my prayers in sending you here to me today, chaplain. Please do come in and sit down." Oh, brother. How much theology is reflected in that one sentence alone? The Lord has answered my prayers in sending you here to me today. Well, Phyllis's spiritual crisis had not so much to do with her diagnosis or prognosis, so much as it had to do with her vocabulary. You see, on New Year's Day that year, she and her husband sat down to make a list of expectations they had of God. She felt uneasy with that word at first and said so. But her husband had assured her that, listen, God has expectations of us, and so we can have expectations of God. And so they made a list of things like success and wealth and new job and all the rest. But now she wondered if she had offended God in using that word, and that's why she has leukemia. You see, Michael, my leukemia is 100% curable, so I think maybe God was just trying to get my attention, give me a little slap on the wrist, you know what I mean? But I'm not sure, though. What if my leukemia were, God forbid, incurable? Do you think it'd be a punishment then? I'm not sure. What do you think? I want to go home, is what I think. She went on to tell me how God had given her cuts in line at the supermarket and found parking places for her right by the front door of an impossibly crowded Costco parking lot. You know what prayer I pray every day, Michael? I say, God, show me your favor today. I just hate wishy-washy prayers, don't you? Why should God show you his favor, I asked. Well, because I'm his precious child. What about the last person in line at the supermarket? Is he God's precious child? Well, he may be. But God has his favorites. Jesus has his favorites. There's a hierarchy in heaven. It says so in the Bible, and I want to be at the top. Well, there you have it. I'm special. Now, as much of a cartoon as Phyllis may seem to be, I assure you her suffering was quite real. And how many of us feel special? I do. Don't you? I'm a good guy. I'm a good friend. I'm a good spouse. I'm a good son. I devote much of my life to service. I eat right. I exercise. What if none of us are special at all? Or what if we all are? That second theme that would say good things have to be earned, it's also closely linked to the idea that it's never available to us now in this moment. It's over there, and I got to earn it. Somehow there's this place called health, success, love, joy, happiness. I'm going to work like a dog to get there. When I get there, I'm never going to move. Don't anybody touch a thing. I'll be okay when? If I could just get this job. If I just had $1,000. If my kid just got into this college. If that person would just love me back. If that person would just go away. If I could just get through this chemo, then I'll be okay. So many belief systems, religious and secular alike, are based on this idea, it's not now and here, it's over there, and I got to earn it. Ruth was this wonderfully wise and soulful older woman with deep roots in her Eastern European Jewish ancestry. She was watching the love of her life, her husband of 60 plus years, slowly slip away over the course of many weeks in the hospital. Michael, she said, I thought I did life the right way. I married the man I loved. We raised three beautiful kids. We gave them great educations. Now they have wonderful families and careers of their own. We were always looking forward to our golden years. And now look, to tell you the truth, I'm going to be 83 years old, and I'm still waiting for the party to begin. Myra was this great gal. In her early 50s, she had a pretty darn colorful past, a not-so-wonderful absent husband, and a very thick Long Island accent. I liked her very much. After we got acquainted for a while, I asked her if any kind of faith or spirituality were part of the equation for her. "Oh, God," she said. "Well, I was raised a Catholic, but I don't know. Church? It was never my thing. I mean, I believe in God and everything, but church, I don't know." And then I got sick and I thought, I should pray or something. But it seemed kind of hypocritical to go to God now when I hadn't gone to God in all these years. You know what I'm saying? And last week, I was across the street in the clinic getting my chemo, and there was this Latino man there praying up a storm with the pictures of the saints and the rosary beads and all that. And I thought, I can't compete with that. As if there's only so much love, grace, healing energy to go around, she wasn't entitled to her share. She hadn't done it the right way. She hadn't earned it. Alex was a very tough young man, 28 years old, with this native street smarts kind of intelligence. He had a very turbulent background, grew up in the Central Valley. He had a brother in prison and a history with gangs, and he was a semi-professional bare-fisted boxer. I didn't know there was even such a thing. When I went in to introduce myself, the only personal artifact in his room was this tattered picture of himself all bloodied up in the boxing ring, taped to the wall. I didn't recognize him. I said, "Who's that?" He said, "It's me. It's the only time I ever lost a fight." "Why do you want that picture up, Alex?" "I want to be sure it never happens again." He had this amazing capacity for reflection and contradiction. "Yeah, Michael, I could pray for God to heal me, but why should he? Why me? Why not the guy down the hall? Why not the kids downstairs, for Christ's sake? Why not everybody in the hospital? Isn't prayer kind of judging God, saying things shouldn't be how they are? Maybe we're just supposed to accept." But then the champion of the ring let his voice be heard. "Michael, you've watched hundreds of people go through these stem cell transplants. What's the best way to do this? I want to be sure of success." And there's that other theme. I have some power or control here. I don't mean to imply or suggest that we don't have power over how we experience our journey and maybe the meaning that we find there. But when it comes to the bigger questions of who gets sick and who doesn't and who dies and who doesn't, it's just out of our hands. And Alex didn't want to accept that. He was in the hospital in and out for the better part of a year. And about a month in, his mom came to stay with him round the clock. She was his warrior, his coach, his rock. She was also a devout evangelical Christian, and she saw to it right away that her boy got back right with the Lord. So that ended our wonderfully complex conversations. "All that ambiguity, that's the devil talking," she would say. Well, this was particularly challenging for me because I must admit I harshly judged that dualistic black and white kind of thinking. And yet that simplistic worldview did seem to bring Alex some comfort. And then I found myself wondering, well, is comfort the whole goal here? What about learning and growth and awakening and discovery? I don't know. But one thing became clear, crystal clear, in fact. Nothing anybody could do or say or pray could alter the fact that the disease would take his life at 28 years old. Oh, well, everything happens for a reason, right? Maybe it's a blessing in disguise. God works in mysterious ways. I believe in the power of love over darkness and fear, and what goes around comes around. I know all of us have heard such statements of faith thousands of times, perhaps coming out of our own mouths. I know I have. Even though any one of us, but no one more than Alex, could make a fairly airtight case for how untrue such notions might be. And yet in our common human journey, we still seem to reach for and expect some notion of goodness and justice and fairness, no matter how unattainable or how impossible to define. Many years ago, I worked for a hospice. And there I met Loretta, who was the niece of the patient. She was his caregiver. And Loretta had the definitive opinion about everything. And she wasn't a bit shy about sharing it. "Michael, do you want to know what prayer I pray every day? I say, God, I know we're all your children, that we are all brothers and sisters under the skin, but God, some of your children, they need a spanking." "They do. Wouldn't you like to see that, Michael? Wouldn't you like to see God just reach down from heaven and grab up Mr. George W. Bush by the britches and go pam, pam, pam like that on the booty? Say, you go sit over there now in the corner. Think about what you've done." "I would. I think it should be on TV. Don't you?" I'm not making it up. And yes, Loretta made me laugh. And yes, there's a hint of vindictiveness in her prayer. But there's also the struggle to claim the promise of justice. It's one of our primary foundational principles as you use. Are we so terribly different? Marcos was a beautiful young man, 30 years old, undergoing the rigors, torturous rigors, of an allogeneic stem cell transplant. In his case, given the chance of success at 20%. Toward the end, without a trace of self-pity and barely able to speak above a whisper, he said, "Michael, if it's my time, it's my time, I guess. That's one way I look at it. What's the other way, Marcos?" "Well, to have faith." "In what?" "Well, that God will heal me." And we looked at how those might not be either or statements. How might, "if it's my time, it's my time," be a statement of deep faith? Is our faith only to be measured by our attachment to outcomes? In my view, it's a statement of a much deeper kind of faith, in our willingness to step off into the unknown without any such attachment to outcomes or even to our notions of goodness and justice and fairness. So in the end, maybe I am special. Maybe I have earned it, God knows. Maybe I can create my reality with my thought, and maybe everything happens for a reason, and what goes around comes around, and maybe there is a force for goodness and justice and fairness in the world. And maybe there's not. I did not set out to articulate the most correct or perfect theology as if such a thing exists. In the end, I don't even think it is so much about what we believe, but our relationship to it, how tightly we hold on to it. I would ask myself, can I move into a deeper experience of peace of mind and heart through a fascination with the mystery that is greater than any need I might have for a singular, solid truth to hold on to? Even if everything I have held to be true my entire life, when it gets right down to it, where the theology meets the road, turns out not to be true at all, or even if it does. Can I be willing for my certainty to collapse at any point in time and to be transformed by that collapse? Might I even fall in love with the process? We'll just have to see, I guess. When I told my mom, she's 85 years old and a lung cancer survivor herself, nearly 13 years out. When I told her about Ruth, that wonderfully wise older woman, my mom, who's pretty wonderfully wise herself, knowingly said, "Oh, honey, the party's always right now. So be it."